The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. Several programs ago, we began a series of programs in which we are looking at a portion of a book which I consider to be a very helpful book so far as containing sensible arguments in refutation of evolution. The book is entitled Darwin's Enigma. It is written by a man by the name of Luther Sunderland. And in earlier programs, I gave you the summary of how the book came to be written, and I won't go back and repeat all of that now. We have been looking at a section in that book that is entitled The Origin of the First Living Cell. And in the last program, we had been discussing the evolutionary idea that the first cell, that the atmosphere, which would be suitable to provide the chemicals that are necessary components of the first cell, would have to be a reducing atmosphere, that it would have to be an atmosphere in which there was no free oxygen present, that there would simply be methane, ammonia, etc. And what we had done was to look at several arguments that have to do, well, I don't say they're arguments, it was simply evidence which indicates rather plainly that there was oxygen present in the early atmosphere on the Earth. And we had been looking at instances where the discussion of that evidence was given. And the articles were written by evolutionists, the point of all of this being that there are evolutionists who are aware that there is sensible evidence to indicate that the early Earth's atmosphere was not a reducing atmosphere, that it was an oxidizing atmosphere. And if I am correct, I think we've already talked about the problems of that the difference between the two. If it was an oxidizing atmosphere, then the components that were there simply would have been destroyed. They would have deteriorated. And this was the basic reason why the desire for the reducing atmosphere came. In any case, a man by the name of John Gribben made a very interesting comment in response to the evidence that was there. His comment was, quote, "All we have to do now is to rewrite all those textbooks and ensure that every school child knows what the best theory of evolution of the Earth's atmosphere and the origin of life is today," indicating that the classical portrayal of this that has been in textbooks now for decades, of the reducing atmosphere, the synthesis in a warm pool someplace of amino acids and simple carbohydrates and so on, finally culminating in an accumulation of all of these things to the point where a cell could come into existence. Noting that this has been what has been presented, and there is evidence now which requires that what appears in textbooks ought to be brought up to date to include the evidence to indicate that such an atmosphere simply was not present. Now, I would like to go here to some comments by Sir Fred Hoyle. Hoyle was a world-renowned astronomer, British astronomer and mathematician, and was a lifelong evolutionist up to a point. In 1981, Sir Fred Hoyle and an Indian by the name of Wickramasinghe, and if I am mispronouncing the name, you'll forgive me, but these two gentlemen wrote a book, and I want to read you some comments about that. Sir Fred Hoyle, famous British mathematician and astronomer who originated the steady-state theory of nucleogenesis, the formation of the universe, the idea that there is somewhere in the universe matter currently coming into existence to balance the deterioration of matter in other parts of the universe, published a book in 1981, Evolution from Space, in which he reversed himself on the origin of life. He and co-author Chandra Wickramasinghe stated that, although atheists all their lives, they had come to the conclusion that the high degree of order and specificity in the universe demanded pre-existing intelligence, even to the limit of God. Now, I find that comment very, very interesting. Man is intelligent. Unsaved men are intelligent. God in the book of Genesis, where he is observing the attempts of early man to build a Tower of Babel, comments that now nothing which they have imagined to do will be restrained from them. So man is highly intelligent. This would bring us to the point then of considering the origin of that intelligence. Is that intelligence the product of millions and billions of years of random chaotic movement of matter somehow? That idea is utterly foolish. It makes absolutely no sense. And I think it's well that that be publicized. They conclude then by saying, even to the limit of God. I do not know what they personally thought about God, but they were at least willing to accept the idea that that intelligence that was demanded, the pre-existing intelligence, could have been God. And to have that comment from a former atheist, I find immensely interesting. They wrote, "Once we see, however, that the probability of life originating at random is so utterly minuscule as to make it absurd, it becomes sensible to think that the favorable properties of physics on which life depends are in every respect deliberate. It is, therefore, almost inevitable that our own measure of intelligence must reflect higher intelligences even to the limit of God." Now, Sunderland's comments. They had come to this conclusion because of their determination of the statistical improbabilities of a single cell originating in the primitive atmosphere in the assumed 4.6 billion years of Earth's history. According to their calculations, the probability of life originating by random processes was one chance in 10 to the 40,000th. Now, that figure, I've commented at some length before about what, in my opinion, is the impossibility of these figures being able to be comprehended. We can read the numbers that are there, but I do not believe it conveys anything comprehensible to the human mind. But it is something that is so unlikely that it could not be accomplished in all the universe in the length of time given even by the evolutionists themselves. And all of this amounts, in my opinion, to not just the improbability, but an impossibility. Now, after they had come to that conclusion, this was their further comment about explaining how evolutionists get around this insurmountable problem. They said, quote, "The tactic is to argue that although the chance of arriving at the biochemical system of life as we know it is admittedly to be utterly minuscule, there is in nature such an enormous number of other chemical systems which could also support life that any old planet, like the Earth, would inevitably arrive sooner or later at one or another of them. This argument is the veriest nonsense, and if it is to be imbibed at all, it must be swallowed with a jorum of strong ale," end quote. And again, I think they're exactly right about this. It is so minuscule that it simply comes to the point where it cannot be considered rationally as a possibility. Hoyle and Wickramasinghe call it hand-waving when evolutionists attempt to sidestep the difficulties by arguing that the first enzymes in the first life were much shorter in their peptide lengths than today. Now, we've talked about protean structure before, and I won't take time here to do that. Proteins, of course, are molecules which, among other things, form what are known as enzymes, chemicals that have the ability of regulating chemical reactions in the cell. And what the comment is indicating is that the argument is that the enzymes in first cells, primitive cells, would have been much simpler. That is, they would have contained fewer amino acids than the enzymes do today. I do not think that is legitimate, but this is really not the place to go into a lengthy discussion of that. Darwin recognized that the arguments for the origin of life by chemical shuffling were weak when he wrote, quote, "If, and oh what a big if, we could conceive in some warm little pond with all sorts of ammonia and phosphoric salts present, that a protean compound was chemically formed ready to undergo still more complex changes," end quote. Now, I would like to go at this point. This is Darwin's writing was, as far as I'm aware, was the first instance of this kind of view of how life came into existence. pools of water on the earth, warm sun shining on them, ultraviolet radiation, etc. And the combination of all of this was simply sufficient not only to produce what the cell needs, but to cause it to come together in the first place. In 1977, Hubert P. Yockey wrote an article that was published in the Journal of Theoretical Biology. It was entitled, A Calculation of the Probability of Spontaneous Biogenesis by Information Theory. I want you to listen to his comment. Quote, the warm little pond scenario was invented ad hoc to serve as a materialistic reductionist explanation of the origin of life. It is unsupported by any other evidence, and it will remain ad hoc until such evidence is found. One must conclude that contrary to the established and current wisdom, a scenario describing the genesis of life on Earth by chance and natural causes, which can be accepted on the basis of fact and not faith, has not yet been written, end quote. And I think he's exactly right about that. Ad hoc here simply means that there was a compelling reason that required some sort of explanation about this, and this warm pool thing was brought into existence simply to try and meet the necessity of the argument. Not that there was scientific evidence for it, not that it was even sensible, but that it was simply something that was necessary in order to try and put some kind of an explanation on that needed argument for evolution. And Yockey is simply observing. There was not at that time evidence. There has not since then been evidence. And even past the time of the writing of the article, there has not been evidence that would support that either. Now, to go back to Hoyle's comments, Hoyle writes about this big if. As the enormity of supposition was slowly revealed in the present century, there was an attempt to evade this difficulty through the invention of pseudoscience. And it is my opinion that much of what we see in evolution is a good example of that pseudoscience. The following excerpt from Nature magazine, 12 November 1981, reported more startling statements by Hoyle on this subject. Quote, the chance that higher life forms might have emerged in this way is comparable with the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the materials therein. Of adherence of biological evolution, Hoyle said that he was at a loss to understand biologists' widespread compulsion to deny what seems to me to be obvious. Now, this is a statement that has been often quoted, usually ridiculed and scoffed at by the evolutionists, but I think it's quite a legitimate point of view, and in my opinion, is very conservative. But he's attempting to deal with the idea that the universe of order and pattern and tremendous complexity and interdependence that we see around us simply cannot be sensibly, intelligently, rationally dealt with on the basis of matter and motion acted on by force over millions and billions of years could bring this into existence. And obviously it is very much contrary to the Genesis account of creation. I think the reason for what we see around us is simply God's creation, and the evolutionary attempts really do not make good sense.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.